Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
All right. We are in effect. Excellent. We are on the air. In your ear holes. Okay. I'm Dan Nalen, and this is the Soundwaves from the Underground podcast, the one and only official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug, an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, is one of the oldest independent publications in the United States, distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action, sports, and subculture, and available at any place cool out there. In this episode, we have great stuff from top to bottom. We talked to some folks from Poor York Studios about their upcoming open house at their art studios in Salt Lake City. Shanghai Kate, one of the featured tattoo artists coming to the Salt Lake City Tattoo Convention. And we talked to the lead actor in a performance of The Screwtape Letters appearing at Kingsbury Hall. It is hard to believe, but it's been a little more than 10 years since the Poor York Studios moved from its downtown Salt Lake City location that first opened in 1996 and moved over to Crystal Avenue. That was in 2002. And one of the coolest things that they do is have these open houses where you can go in, check out what the artists are working on, their works in progress, hang out, have a drink. It's a blast. The studio houses several well-known contemporary artists from around Utah, including Paul Vincent Bernard, Ryan K. Peterson, Justin Wheatley, and 50 more. More. Amazing. Slug senior staff writer Mariah Mella sat down with the founder, Brad Slaw, to talk about the studio and their upcoming open studio event.
Give me a little background. We are in the Slug offices and their sound studios, and you're kind of familiar with this building, and tell me how this kind of relates to you being now with Poor York.
Well, when I first came back to Salt Lake City after grad school, that was in 1995, and this was the only like game in town. I mean, this was the old art space. Mm-hmm. And what you did if you wanted studio space at the time, it was either the Guthrie, which I didn't even know about, and that was this place. And you put your name on a list, and I was 200 and something. And, you know, I asked him, like, well, how what's your turnover like?
How likely is it?
Yeah, I've never, maybe I'm still on the list.
I know.
But I've never gotten a call.
If the list still exists,
right. Essentially ended up happening is that I sublet a little corner of a warehouse from a guy who, after a few months, he kind of skipped town. He was having financial troubles, and he skipped out on his lease. And so I ended up basically taking over the lease and dividing up this warehouse into studio spaces, and that's kind of where.
Well, I'm glad they let you take it over, and you weren't like raided by cops or
indeed,
had you know.
Indeed, actually,
out on your limb.
I was never raided by cops. However, I was paid several visits by the building inspector. Turns out you're supposed to have a building permit for these things, and so I learned that as we went along.
Say, I'm like usually artists. It's not really the business background I find, and so
yeah.
You've kind of had to turn from the artist to the business and political world probably to get
it's
the been
a journey for sure. I've made lots of mistakes, but that was two spaces ago.
So which space was that?
That was it was on 3rd West and 4th North.
Oh.
Actually, and now it's kind of a sort of film studio. They've had architects in there, kind of a design studio. Trent Alvey owns that, and Bob Rock of it, North Star or something like that.
So still kind of artist-related.
Sort of, yep.
Nice. And then you moved to, was it 7th West and 7th South? Or
real 7th South, and actually it's like 530 West. So
okay.
Right there, that's where Clint Call's design is. It's right across from Frida Bistro.
Yeah.
And we were there for 5 years, and then
And how many artists did you have there?
I want to say we had about 26 studios. So we had more artists than that.
Sure, because people just packed them in and cohabitated.
It was about 26 artists, to tell you the truth. 26 to 30 artists. You know, we never had any more than 30 over there.
How is that to maintain and manage?
Well, you know, artists are always up to something. But the truth is that the whole reason why you do something like Poor York is because you want to have a community of creative people around who are doing interesting stuff. And, you know, we really had a lot of terrific people in that building. We had some young folks, and occasionally at the open studios, young folks.
Oh, it was the best place to party on Gallery
Yeah,
Strong,
young
for
folks
sure.
Like to drink, and sometimes they drank a little too much and got a little bit kooky. It's perhaps mellowed out with time over our new place. But yeah, we did have some epic little nights there back
Maybe
in the day.
Those people got older, but now we're going to tell everyone at Slug that listens to this to come, and it's going to get raging.
It is it's a fun party. To this day, it's a fun party. Although, you know, like I say, we want everyone to come and have a good time there.
Keep in mind that you are partying around
If you want to go and go off the rails, our party ends at 10, and you still can.
Yeah,
someplace
can
else.
Somewhere.
That would be great. There's an after party somewhere in the valley.
But you can't stay here.
Absolutely. Right.
So now you're on Crystal Avenue, which I know if you're not familiar with the area, that seems to be one of the bigger challenges, is trying to get people there.
Sure.
So where exactly is it?
We did move about 6 years ago to our permanent location, which is on Crystal Avenue, as you mentioned. It's 126 West Crystal, and Crystal is 2590 South.
And it's kind of an art community down there. You have a couple of other art residents.
Actually, you know, some of them predate us, and that would be like Spectrum Studios, which is a glass studio, one street over on Malvern. And then there's another studio right there and sometimes they open up on the same night. I think it's like Studio 195. I don't know what they call themselves, but they do primarily sculpture. I mean, those guys are, you know, they get in there and they're kind of industrial and metal and they're pouring stuff, and it's pretty groovy what they do. Who's also kind of moved into the neighborhood, Signed and Numbered. That's Leah Bell's place.
Mm-hmm. And you've got Vertical Diner.
Vertical Diner right around the corner.
And have dinner at Pat's Barbecue.
And Pat's Barbecue
over.
If you're not vegan. That would be the other end of the spectrum for sure. And
And then after you're done looking at art, you can just head over to the bowling alley over at the Bonwood Bowl.
Absolutely.
And finish up your night.
Still there, the Bonwood Bowl.
So tell me about the Open Studio, because it's an equinox show, which I love because I'm a big fan of the solstice and the equinox and the changing of seasons and what that means. And so it's a magical night as far as just, you know, again, the changing of seasons and what's kind of happening around us and in nature. But tell me what happens at Poor York on that night.
It doesn't always fall exactly on the equinox, although this time it does.
Nice.
It's right on the 22nd, which is the back half of the equinox. And usually what we do is the fourth Friday of March and the fourth Friday of September. So it's usually really close to the equinoxes. And basically what we do is these are the only two nights a year that Poor York is open to the public. Other than that, it's, you know, like a working studio. And so, yeah, we're in there kind of making our stuff the rest of the year. And then we have, this big party a couple of times a year. And people can buy work at the Open Studio or not. People can come and have fun.
Well, they can look and decide and shop around, window shop.
Indeed.
And figure out who their favorite artists are to follow the careers, you know, in the future. And come back when you have cash if
Indeed.
You don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, people are invited. You know, if you know an eccentric millionaire and you want to bring them along.
Please do.
Yeah, absolutely. Eccentric millionaires.
Rich friends are
always
allowed.
Always welcome. But if you're not and you don't know an eccentric millionaire, you're still invited.
Nice. So how many artists are currently residents of Poor York in this location?
I think we're at about 53 right now. Not all of them open up their studios, but most do on the night of the Open Studio.
Like about a concentrated amount of people to come.
Right.
You know, gallery stroll, you have to go from gallery to gallery, and you'll maybe see six artists or something in a night. So
yeah, and we'll have 42 participating artists this time. Some of them are guest artists, invited artists, but most of them are people who have studios at Poor York and who are working right there in the space. And then we all clean our spaces up and like get out some, you know, hors d'oeuvres and maybe, you know, pour something for folks as they come on through. And it's fun.
I love the fact that you get to go from studio to studio. One, because it's a concentrated group, so you can see so many. But also, so you get to see the habitat. You know, it's almost like you're going to, you know, if you were to look at a zoo and see what, you know, the natural habitat of this animal is. And it's the natural habitat of the artist, you know. Yeah. And even though they've cleaned it up for you, there's still, you know, paint splatters, or you can see workstations and work in progress where, you know, if you wait till it's all finished, some of that stuff you'll never see.
Yeah, it is a very different experience from going to a gallery, I think, or, you know, to a museum. I mean, some of those, I love museums, I love galleries, but, you know, they do kind of clean stuff up for you. And believe it or not, when you come to the Open Studio, it represents a good couple of days. Studio takes like 3 days to get cleaned up, but it's still pretty scruffy around the edges, and it's, you know, it's a different experience.
I think that's what makes it charming.
Yeah.
Is to be able to see, like I said, but how your process works too, because it's, you know, a lot of fun to see the finished, and then also those canvases that just have a few marks on them, or the sculptures that have yet to be defined.
Yeah, and if you want to talk with the artists, I mean, the artists are right there. Sometimes people are shy and they don't want to do that, but that's what the wine is for, so you're not quite as shy at the end of the evening. I mean, the artists are there, and they can show you like what they're doing right in their space. You know, this is how I do my process. And we have a lot of different kind of artists. We've got like printmakers, sculptors, collage artists, you know, mixed media. Who did I leave out? Oh, ceramicists. And I'm going to get in trouble because I'm going to miss somebody. Did I say photographers? I think I probably did. We also have a lot of painters. I like myself and my wife, Tracy, who also is a ceramic artist.
So it's March 22nd. What kind of timing do we get to come?
Oh, yeah. It goes from 6 to 10. Frequently, it will go a little bit later than 10, but we say 6 to 10. So
if you get there at 9:50, you don't maybe you're not going to be ushered out right away.
Oh,
you might be able to get a few in
still. Yeah, you'll be able to walk on through. I think very few people actually, you know, like, fold up at 10.
And it's fun. Maybe you don't have a chance to see everybody, but it's not like you have to, but you can pop in or just poke your head in and see if it's something that you're interested in.
There are 40 studios, and some of them are shared by, you know, a couple of artists. So you may or may not make it all the way through. It is quite a maze. I mean, there's 16,000 square feet, but people do. They make it through, and it is. It's really fun. I mean, you can come through, and it's really eclectic, so there might be something that you're really interested in, but then maybe the next thing is like, well, it's not my cup of tea, you know, but then maybe the thing after that is. It's sort of...
It's kind of a buffet of artists.
It is, and it's not like a curated show.
Sure.
It is, you know, the people who are making art, and it matters to them, and so they're putting it out there.
About these invited guests, or were they? Did you decide to invite them?
Well, you know, we invite artists, you know, just about every single time. Sure,
please, Brad.
Yeah, we have, you know, like guest artists. This time, Tony Smith, who has been a perennial favorite. You know, he comes maybe once every 18 months, sometimes once a year. Emeritus professor up at the U. He's terrific. Phoenix Osterman, who I guess her artist's nom de guerre is Reclaimed Sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll be an invited artist this time. Other guest artists, Tia Shepherd, who I don't know, but Stephanie Dykes has sponsored her in her studio. I think Stephanie has otherwise committed this time, so I'm not sure if she's going to be around. I know she's been a super busy camper with lots of international shows that she's been doing, so I'm not exactly sure what's going on there. Another guy named Ron Butkovich, who I think is a jewelry artist.
Well, that's great. So, I mean, it seems like you kind of have... Those invited artists are either people in the community that you're familiar with, or that someone at the gallery has, like you said, sponsored in.
Right.
So, I mean, it seems like it's such a family of artists that are there in Port York. So do you have spaces that are still available, or if there's artists listening that say, I want to be in a community like that, I want to have that opportunity, can they apply or talk to you about
they
it?
They absolutely can. I don't have any studios currently available.
And, but you
and
have a list.
I do have a list.
And you'll keep that list?
But it's not 200 artists long. You know, if people want a space, they definitely should contact me, and they can do that at, you know, at bslaw.com or through the Port York Studios website.
Okay.
You know, that's, you just click on contact and say, hey, I'd like to know more. Be patient. Basically, most of the administrative duties, nearly all of them, are done by me.
And you're also an artist.
I am trying to paint a painting, and then, you know, I teach at Salt Lake Community College. The one thing is that almost all of us out there have some kind of day job that we're doing. We're very serious about our artwork, but we live in kind of a community that doesn't necessarily let all of us just be full-time artists.
Sure.
So if it takes me a little while to get back to you, don't fret. Yes, don't fret. Don't fear. You know, people who are persistent and who really want a space and who are serious about, you know, creating work, you know, get a space ultimately.
So stalking pays off.
Stalking, right? It always does. Everybody knows that, right? Yeah.
How else are you going to get in there? You just got to stalk him.
Yeah.
Port York's Open Studio will take place on Friday, March 22nd from 6 until 10 p.m. It is entirely free for all ages. To find out more about the studio and to get more information on the over 50 artists who reside there and do work, check them out online at portyorkstudios.com. Creative Adult are a four-piece punk band based out of San Francisco that originally formed a mere year ago and immediately released a 7-inch debut called Dead Air. Earlier this year, the group released a follow-up split single with the vibrating antennas called Happy Hour. Here is that song, Dead Air, from the 2012 EP of the same name.
Touch my body.
Alternative Adult will be in Salt Lake City playing at the Shred Shed on March 20th, along with Filth Lords, Foster Body, and White Lung. For more information on the band, visit them online at creativeadult.com and make sure to put a little dash between creative and adult. Kate Hellenbrand is quite a character. I've interviewed her myself in the past, and she is better known as Shanghai Kate in the tattoo world. She's a longtime artist based out of Austin, Texas, who's had a career in tattooing that goes back 40-plus years, managing and working in shops all across the United States, including one right here in Utah way back when. She has worked alongside of artists such as Sailor Jerry, Ed Hardy, and Jack Rudy. Her work has appeared in several magazines, on tons of TV shows, and she was once even asked to lecture for Mensa and the Rotary Club. Pretty amazing story. Slug writer Megan Kennedy spoke with Shanghai Kate over the phone about her career and her artwork.
Tell me about your amazing career. How did you get started in tattooing? And did you have a history with art outside of tattooing, or was tattooing your first experience with art?
No. I started drawing when I was about 2 years old.
Wow.
I drew more than I talked. And to me, it was a magical way to manifest my reality. I wanted a pony really badly, and I drew one and drew one and drew one. And then when I was about five, I got one. So I was like, well, this works. So then I went to art school in Los Angeles. I studied art all the way through high school and into university. And then when I got to L.A. when I was 19, I went to the Art Center School of Design and then also Chouinard School of Fine Arts for a little while, and then I got a job as a graphic artist and graphic designer. So I've always been involved in arts, and you know, growing up on the farm, I fell in love with tools, and then that led me to the tools that are involved in graphics, because they were really fun. They don't have them anymore. Now everybody's on a computer, and that's when I left that field. Anything handmade, you know, whenever I can use my hands, it's great for me, so it's what I enjoy. When I started dating a photographer who was interested in the world of tattooing, I fell in love with this guy, and so I was around him all the time, and we got to have some extended experiences with watching people like Huck Spalding tattoo, and Tom DeVita tattoo, and then Ed Hardy tattoo, and then Michael decided he wanted to tattoo, but there were no women tattooing, so it was a man's job. And so I was the hostess. I was the one making the coffee and, you know, hamburgers for people who came over to get tattooed in our little tattoo studio when we opened it in New York City in 1971. But I was not ever considering doing anything with tattooing. It was like Yoko Ono. she came in and broke up the Beatles.
Right.
You know? Women interfering in those kinds of jobs was not looked upon as, you know, it wasn't seen kindly. So, I mean, she still carries that, you know, that curse that she broke up the Beatles. So I, you know, when someone asked me if I wanted to ever tattoo, I said, no, I don't want to be, you know, Yoko Ono. But then the client said, but I know that you have artistic ability, and I would really think you'd do a good job. So I said, well, I want to see how the little tool works. And so I picked up the tool, and that was it. It's the magic tool.
How was it being, especially with that atmosphere around you, how was it being one of the first female tattoo artists, and what kind of obstacles did you run into, and how did you deal with them?
Well, it's interesting. People ask me this question. I have no idea what it's like to be a male tattoo artist. So, you know, my only experience is completely subjective of how it was for me, as not necessarily a woman. However, you know, that came up a lot. You know, it was rough. I mean, I was not trusted. I was questioned. I was demeaned. I was supported. You know, I have a golden ticket in my entry into tattooing, because the first people that I started working with were, you know, Ed Hardy, Sailor Jerry, Paul Rogers, you know, the giants of the business. So I can't really complain and say that I had a terrible, terrible, you know, entry into this field. It wasn't until I got to California after I'd been tattooing a year in New York that I ran into the whole military mindset of tattooing and the turf and the paranoia and some of the more negative things. And then I was threatened and questioned. And then all I did was just, you know, do what I always did and what I, which I, you know, the, what I know is to be true in any situation where you're new, which is to keep your mouth shut and your ears and eyes open. And so that's how I was allowed to hang around with these people, because I was respectful. I knew my place. I just was there to learn. I was dedicated in my interest, and I was talented enough that they felt that I had potential, and that I was, and I was smart, and I was funny. So, you know, I tried to be the very best person that I could be in that situation, and that allowed me to stay another day. I also had to work not only my shift, but the shift of all the men. But I did that gladly, because that's how I was learning.
Mm-hmm.
But I had to work, you know, 2-3 times harder than anybody else around me. So, you know, yeah, it had some interesting moments, and but I'm not going to say it was terrible and I was abused, and, you know, to paint a picture of that. I mean, I was threatened more than a few times.
Jeez.
But, you know, I have this little saying that if you tell me I can't do something and you try to make it hard for me, I'm just going to show you that you can't win in that situation. I'm going to prove you to be wrong. I'm going to do whatever it is that I can to succeed.
That's wonderful. Woman and, after my own heart.
And so that's what I do.
Wonderful.
And that's innate. That's innate. That's not something that I consciously wake up every morning and say I'm going to do. That's just how I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a horseback rider, you grew up riding horses, you know, and I'm just making this up as I go along here, but I think there's some truth in it, you know. I mean, you are, when you grow up on a farm and you are on your pony and he throws you, what do? You know, do you stay down or do you get up and get back on the horse? Do you become partners with that animal? You know, tame it so that, you know, you have a relationship. So that's, I think, where that comes from with me, is that I was born in the right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
To do what I do.
That cowboy mindset, that's good. So you learned, you mentioned you learned the tutelage of many awesome tattoo artists and grandfathers in the field, especially Sailor Jerry. So all that must have been an incredible experience. So how do you feel like that affected you as an artist?
Every which way. Every way possible. I mean, you know, I was so new in my beginnings. I was so new in my career that I really didn't know what I was doing, you know. And it was so early in the career of really the technologically advanced tattooing that we see today. So it was evolving very quickly, and Jerry was one of the evolvers. He was one of the people who continually pushed the envelope and discovered new things, and he was a genius, flat-out genius. But being that, you know, fresh into the industry, I didn't really, you know, I was like, I don't know, groundwater. I mean, there was, you know, anything would affect me. So what did affect me more than any of the technological information or the artistic bent that he had or whatever was his influence on me on how to be a tattoo artist,
mm-hmm.
how to think of oneself as a tattoo artist, how to think of this art, and how to conduct oneself through this industry. That was the most important lesson I could have learned in that time, in the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big part of what's missing in tattooing today. It's what I continue to carry and continue to work with throughout my career. It's the best lesson I could have ever learned.
Can you elaborate on that? Like, what? Can you give me some examples of how you carry yourself compared to maybe some of the younger artists today that are not doing that well?
Well, you know, first of all, people don't know that aren't doing that well. You mean that they're not making money?
The ones that aren't carrying themselves as a tattoo artist, not really respecting the craft, as it sounds like Jerry taught you to do.
Well, yeah, they're doing it all for the wrong reasons. First of all, their ego's involved,
mm-hmm.
and that never is
right.
That's never a pretty picture. You have to have a strong ego, and yet you have to be egoless. You have to know that you are called to do this work, and that this work is holy work, it's sacred work. We're shamans. We change people's bodies forever. We put the dreams of their insides onto their outsides. It's worth it to be respected in every sense of the word because it is holy work. It encompasses every other kind of work there is, from chemistry to metallurgy to anatomy to physiology to chemistry to mythology, theology, psychology. Everything you can think of comes into tattooing. It takes a lifetime to learn, first of all, just some of all of that stuff. So anybody who comes to me with an attitude and they've been tattooing 2 years, I have no time to talk with them. Period. So the ego is a big thing. Also, I think tattoo artists are born, not made. And I think anyone who approaches this as a hobby, or anyone who thinks that this is a get-rich-quick scheme, or anyone who is in this for the fame or, you know, the notoriety, or thinks that they're the important thing in this business, they are not what's important in this business. They are the facilitator. They are the person that the energy flows through to the other person. They are not the person that is making this happen. It's coming from other places. It's coming from 200,000 years of history. So everybody stands on very tall shoulders. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to see kids who come into this business and they have this attitude that they're really the be-all, end-all. Their egos are really huge. You know, they're so cool. They're this and they're that. You know, and then after 2 years, they realize, you know, the gravity of what they're doing. And then they become humble, and then they become good people, and then they become good artists. I was able to learn from Jerry how to not only be that, but also be arrogant in the right way. To say, this is my space. I'm the queen of this space. You come here for work by me, so I know the rules. I know what's going to work, what's not going to work, and I'm not going to violate the rules for money, or because you saw Lindsay Lohan have it, or any of the other reasons that people are coming and getting all these terribly placed, horribly done tattoos. Mm-hmm. A lot of them. Not all of them. But, you know, the first 5 years of this business, you should just be sitting with your eyes and ears open and your mouth shut and just learn as much as you can at the hands of whomever is near you who's going to teach you.
Wonderful. So it sounds like with the gain in popularity that tattooing has gotten in the last 10 to 20 years, it sounds like maybe you feel like, especially with the reality TV programs that are related to it, that maybe it's not such a good thing for the industry, like it's diluting it a little bit. Does that sound correct?
Oh, of course it's diluting it.
Yeah.
Of course it is. It's showing us, first of all, it has nothing to do with tattooing.
Right.
The reality TV shows have absolutely nothing to do with tattooing. They're scripted. They are put together by producers who sit in Hollywood in cubicles, who probably have no tattoos at all, have never been in a tattoo shop, and don't like tattoos.
Right.
So they come up with these half-assed scenarios of Kat Von D chasing down whoever's shitting all over the bathroom for a half an hour to entertain us. You know, tattoo artists, what goes on those shows is is not what happens in tattoo shops.
Right.
I mean, if anybody were to do a real... See, those tattoo shops that are built on the television channels, like Miami Ink, mm-hmm. LA Ink, New York Ink, London Ink, they didn't go into tattoo shops and film a tattoo shop. They built a soundstage and then hired specific tattoo artists that would bring drama to the program.
Mm-hmm.
That's how those shows are put together. It has nothing to do with reality. Those tattoo shops do now exist because, you know, they have a sound stage there, and so these people who are not being filmed will stay there and tattoo. You know, they've created a tattoo shop, but that tattoo shop did not exist prior to
right.
the filming. So, you know, it's all manipulated. You may as well be watching Roxanne. In fact, you should be watching Roxanne instead of this because, you know, you'd learn something from Roxanne. You're not going to learn anything from any of these reality shows.
Shanghai Kate will be in town for the Salt Lake City Tattoo Convention running March 22nd through the 24th at the Salt Palace in downtown SLC. For more information on Kate and her business and maybe book yourself a little time in her chair when she's here, visit her online at shanghaikate.com. This is your weekly daily calendar for the week starting on March 19th. As always, you'll want to go to slugmag.com, every damn day, and check out all the events going on a day-to-day basis. That thing is updated constantly. I went through it and found a few highlights for myself to drop on you right now. On Tuesday, March 19th, Clutch. I'm going to go ahead and say that might be Bill Frost's favorite band, for those people who know Bill. It's a big rockin' show, and it'll be at the Depot. Also, right across town, the Unknown Mortal Orchestra will be doing a fabulous show at the Urban Lounge. They have Foxgen opening up the show. It should be a blast. That'll be one of the hotter shows of the springtime. Oh, zip forward a little bit till Friday, March 22nd. We have a great punk bluegrass band called Old Man Markley. I've seen them before. They always tear it up at Burt's Tiki Lounge, and they'll be doing that once again on Friday the 22nd. Same night, over down to the Provo at Velour, J. William Henderson, formerly of Band of Annuals, and Britton Jones, still currently of the Devil Whale, are sharing the stage for a show at Velour down in Provo. And, of course, that is the opening day of the SLC Tattoo Convention that runs all weekend at the Salt Palace. Same night, over at the Complex, the Aurum Band, who might now be considering themselves from Las Vegas, apparently. Imagine Dragons playing a sold-out show. Those guys have gotten super huge of late, and that show will be packed. But they'll be coming back around later in the spring, it turns out, down to the Utah County, apparently. Saturday, March 23rd, Wanagani doing that gypsy rock thing they do so well at Bar Deluxe. Their show is always a fabulous multimedia experience. And the same night, Saturday, March 23rd, I know a lot of people are going to be geeked up about Animal Collective, the psychedelic experimental band originally out of Baltimore, currently based in New York City. They're coming back around for the first time in quite a while. Down at Velour that night, The Moth and the Flame are headlining, one of Provo's better bands, in my honest opinion, on the 23rd. And then on Sunday, March 24th, a fabulous live act, P-Lander Z, Japanese cartoon characters come to life and rocking it up at Kilby Court. A fabulous show awaits. That's your weekly daily calendar. Be sure to go to slugmag.com. Check it every day for new information. As always, you can enter your own events there as well. That is free to you, and for a mere $5 a month or $50 a year, you can add some quality, cool content to your listings. Our second band of the episode is yet another West Coast punk band. These guys from Vancouver, British Columbia. They are called White Lung. They first started almost 10 years ago now, back in 2006. And the four-piece first album was called It's the Evil, and that was released just in June 2010 on Deranged Records. More recently, the band followed it up with a highly acclaimed sophomore album called Sorry. That was last spring in May of 2012. We're going to listen to a song from their full-length album, Sorry. This is a song called Bag. previously mentioned, the band will be rolling through Salt Lake City, playing at the Shred Shed on March 20th with Filth Lords, Foster Body, and Creative Adult. For more information about them, their albums, their tour, visit them online at whitelung.ca. That special Canadian ending. And for even more in-depth information about White Lung, be sure to pick up the March issue of Slug and whip it right open to the cover story. Novelist C.S. Lewis came up with the idea for the Screwtape Letters when he was listening to Adolf Hitler deliver his famous Reichstag speech way back in 1940 over the BBC radio. Listening to Hitler talk gave Lewis the idea to do a book about human nature. The play, taken from the book, stars Brent Harris. He's basically the lead narrator. He's a one-man gang. Slug writer Megan Kennedy chatted with Brent Harris about the production and its success traveling across the country.
Tell me what's going on with switching off the lead role in this play with Max. Are you taking over to some dates?
Yeah, actually, we're sort of alternating. I think, I'm not really sure what the full schedule is, but I think that I'm doing most of the dates. But Max has been doing it for several years, and he wants to start working on some other projects that they're working on to try to bring to the stage. One of them I think they're working on is another work of C.S. Lewis called The Great Divorce.
Mm-hmm.
They're just in workshops now with that right now. So he's involved with that, and he wanted to be able to have a little bit more time to work, to concentrate on that.
Awesome. So tell me about how you got involved. Did he ask you to audition? Did you just traditionally audition? How did you get involved in the role?
Yeah, I just got a call from the casting director and asked me to look at it and come in and read for it. And that was about, that was last summer. And so I had a couple of auditions and then started rehearsal in November.
Awesome.
And then I started performing the show in January in D.C.
Wonderful. How are you liking it compared to, I mean, you've done Broadway, you've been in a lot of villainous roles with, I mean, with Iago,
yeah,
and Scar, and
I
even
a lot of bad guys.
Even Lucifer,
yeah.
Yes,
I do a lot of Shakespeare, a lot of villains, a lot of bad guys. I've been really enjoying this experience a lot. I've never done something, I mean, this is not a one-person show, mm-hmm. but there's another character in the play, but the other character does not speak, so... in essence, it's a long monologue that I'm doing, about an 80-minute monologue. And so I've never really done something quite that sustained. So it's a different challenge for me, which I like a lot. It's very interesting to figure out how to go from one moment to the next and sustain the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, for those unfamiliar, the novel Screwtape Letters itself is written in the epistola story style, which is just letters. So, like, how do you go about getting in the mindset to transform those letters into, like you said,
right.
like basically just a giant monologue?
Right. Well, they've done a great job, Max, and the adapters have done a great job making this, which, as you say, is a novel in letters, and they've made it very dramatic. And I don't quite understand how they've been able to do that, but it is very dramatic. I think one of the things about it that happens in the play is that you see Screwtape's emotional transformation, which maybe you don't see as much in the book because it's more controlled and he's writing letters. But in the play, when you dramatize it, there's really a lot of room to explore the emotional range that Screwtape goes through, which is quite large. And there's a big emotional arc that he takes, a big emotional journey. And I think that's one of the most fascinating things about the play. And you don't see it. It's very hidden. It's very covert in the book. And the other thing is that they've added a character. They've not really added a character, but they took a very small character in the book, Toadpipe, who is Screwtape's secretary. And Toadpipe is actually taking dictation in the play. And Toadpipe is a very strange sort of reptilian, demonic creature who doesn't speak but does vocalize and expresses a lot of reaction to what Screwtape is going through. And sometimes, even though Toadpipe is a sort of a lower life form, the audience can tell, can relate to Toadpipe maybe more than they relate to Screwtape sometimes, because Toadpipe is experiencing and understanding certain things that maybe even Screwtape doesn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
So they've added this sort of dynamic relationship in the play, both between screw tape and toad pipe, and also between toad pipe and the audience.
And I've read that C.S. Lewis got his inspiration for Screwtape after listening to the Reichstag radio address from Hitler, which is pretty heavy. So to have that association not only with a mythological supernatural darkness, but a real, a very human association with evil, it seems like it would be draining as an actor to tap into that after night after night. So has it affected you at all in that any way? And how do you unwind from something that's kind of that heavy and basically you're carrying on your shoulders, at least vocally, the whole time?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's several aspects of looking at that. One is the purely technical aspect where you do have to sort of pace yourself to get through the evening, you know, keeping in mind what's ahead, what you have to reserve for the next letter or the end of the play. But really, you know, it's a kind of a ride you just start. A lot of the preparation, a lot of the anxiety about doing it just comes from, you know, preparing for it, you know, anticipating it. Once you start this journey, you just go on it, you just do it, and it sort of just takes you there, and it takes you where you have to go, and wherever you are, that's where you are. And you're right, it does have some, you know, a lot of emotional, heavy elements to it, but it also has a lot of humor in it, and it's very interesting to see what the different audiences react to, what they laugh at. You know, different audiences laugh at different things.
Mm-hmm.
And the humor is definitely a part of it, but I think that's the most surprising thing that people take away from the play, is that a lot of people say to me, oh, I didn't realize it was going to be so funny, because it does, as you said, deal with a lot of heavy topics. And heavy emotional responses. As you say, he was writing this at the beginning of the war when things looked really bad. And there was this very palpable, real presence in the world who seemed demonic. So he was reacting to a lot of that. So it's very surprising how he was able to get a lot of humor into it.
Mm-hmm. And it's been getting amazing reviews across the country. And like
yeah.
you said, the humor seems to be what offsets what would otherwise be a really depressing and dramatic and dark night for audiences, but it's speaking to people, and it seems like it's speaking across you know, lines of believers. Like, you don't have to necessarily
right.
adopt the Christian attitude or likewise be an atheist to enjoy it. So what is it, do you think, about this production that is equalizing, if you will, the audiences
yeah.
As far as religiosity goes? Because it seems like even non-believers
well,
are enjoying it.
I think the important thing about this, and I think ultimately what this play is about, is human behavior and human psychology. Yes, C.S. Lewis is writing from a Christian point of view, and he is writing from a belief that devils are real and that there's a real spiritual warfare going on. But when you watch the play or when you read the book, you're very aware of how perceptive Screwtape is and how perceptive C.S. Lewis is about human psychology, the way we do things, the way humans do things. And I think that's where a lot of the humor comes from. Screwtape is describing the way the humans act and what humans always do. And he's almost always right. So
yeah.
the audience finds itself in a position of agreeing with the devil and agreeing that humans are sort of in a pretty precarious situation. And damnation, I think, means a lot of different things to different people. You know, it can be a sort of a damnation in a religious aspect, or it can mean damnation in terms of just losing yourself, losing your sense of who you are and your awareness of yourself and your awareness of the need for things like compassion and understanding. And I think that that's a lot of what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. So the play's been to Utah here a few times. So would you say that you guys are returning? Are you getting a good response from our crowds, mainly because maybe the LDS culture is so strong and they kind of relate to that? Or is there anything special about Utah that keeps bringing the play back?
You know, I really don't know. I just, all I know is that, you know, wherever I've done the play, and it's, you know, I've done D.C., I've done Orlando and Chattanooga and Birmingham, and, you know, wherever we've gone, there's been a big, big audience. And as you say, it's a diverse audience. There's some people that come for a religious reason, and there are other people that come for a literary reason, because a lot of people know the book,
mm-hmm.
and they've heard of the book, and they're curious about it. And it's a really interesting, solid, complicated, vivacious piece of literature that I think people respond to. And what Max and the Adapters have done so well is they've made a really good piece of theater out of it. And theater, I think, is best when it's ambiguous and thought-provoking, mm-hmm. and I think that's what this play does. It makes people think about some big issues in life, and also, you know, it makes them find some amusement in the way, in their recognition of the way they're living their lives. And so, I don't know, I think it's pretty universal. I think wherever the play goes, it seems to attract a lot of good response and a lot of thoughts and a lot of emotion.
As an actor being on a touring production like this, do you find it's more exhausting? It's harder to keep your energy up over that as opposed to, you know, the same theater you can, you know, if you're stable in a certain city night after night?
This is a different type of tour. I've toured with Lion, the national tour of Lion King. I played Scar in that tour, and that was an ongoing tour where you just went from city to city to city. You did 8 shows a week.
Wow.
And usually stayed in a city for a month or so, and then went right on to the next city and started all over again. And that was exhilarating, but also incredibly exhausting. This tour, usually go out on the weekends. We go out, for instance, we come to Salt Lake City. I will come out there on Friday and do 2 shows on Saturday, and then come right back to New York on Sunday. So it's very quick.
Oh, okay.
And then I have a lot of free time in between. So it's very intense, the travel and the performance day. Those 3 or 4 days are very, very intense. And it's basically the travel that's exhausting. It's much more exhausting than doing the show.
Mm-hmm.
But it's great to have time in between to sort of refresh and to sort of relook at the play in a different way and come back to it from a different angle.
Yeah, that sounds like a much more refreshing way to do it. That's wonderful,
yeah,
that you get to go home at least after each production.
Exactly.
You played several bad guys, as we mentioned, and you've also played some good guys like Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. So you've been at both ends of the spectrum, kind of, and I mean all the way to the dark side, too, with Lucifer and Faustus. So do you have a preference now on playing good or bad guys? Do you find one more fun to do or one you prefer the most?
As I said, I'm most used to doing the bad guys, so I sort of know the sort of default mode to go into when I'm in a bad guy part. And actually, playing Atticus, which I did about a year and a half ago in New Jersey, was quite a surprise to me. And it was very difficult, because it was very difficult to find that sort of conflict or that sort of dark place that I always usually try to go to or try to find. Because I think we all have a dark part of ourselves.
Absolutely.
And I think that Atticus does, actually. And I think that was one of the most interesting parts of playing that part, was I think Atticus has some hidden parts of his life that he can't talk about, he can't address. But he's made the decision to become compassionate and rational. It was very refreshing to play that part, and it was surprising in a way. And it was actually inspiring. So it's great to play those good guys, because it can really, you know, it gives me a model and a lesson to live to sort of improve my own life.
Awesome.
Bye. It's great to play the villains, because you can get all the bad energy out of you on stage and do things and say things on stage that you're not really permitted to do in society or on the street.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of vent those bad thoughts and those bad things that you have inside of you. It's sort of like therapy.
Yeah.
You sort of get it all out of your system on stage, and people enjoy it. People really love villains. They really like the bad guys on stage.
And
it's an interesting phenomenon.
The Screwtape Letters will be coming to Salt Lake City on March 23rd at Kingsbury Hall for a mere 2 performances, one at 4 p.m. and one at 8 p.m. For more information on the play, visit the play online at screwtapeonstage.com. Once again, thank you for listening to the Soundwaves from the Underground podcast. And for all things Slug Magazine, be sure to visit us every day at slugmag.com. We're going to have Jeffrey Stedman from Yelp, Utah back in a couple of short weeks to talk about brunch. Oh, your favorite meal in between breakfast and lunch. You know you love it. We want to know what your favorite place is to get a late morning bite after you've been, up maybe a little late the night before. Either send us an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That line is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Give us a good suggestion. We just might play you on the air. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and produced by Gavin Sheehan. The associate producers are Esther Moronio, Ricky Vigil, Alexander Ortega, and Dan Nalen. That's me. Executive producer is Angela H. Brown. The theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. The main logo and art design is by T. Doan, and the technical design is by Kate Colgan. Be sure to tune in next week when you will hear all of the highlights from South by Southwest from all of your favorite Slug writers. Thank you for listening.